Welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Caroline.
And Caroline, maybe we should call this the podcast. Caroline, I got some weed puns. And I'm not afraid to use them.
I look forward to this entire episode being peppered, sprinkled with puns.
And I would also like to note that Caroline is decked out in green today.
Totally by accident.
Sure you are. First of all, though, before we get into this women and weed conversation, I would like to dedicate this episode to our San Francisco lady listeners, some of whom participate in weed farming and have reported to us that they listen to Stuff Mom Never Told You while they are trimming buds. So ladies, we're thinking of you right now. So with that, let's talk a little bit about the history of marijuana, specifically in the United States, because a global history would, let's face it, would just take too long.
Yeah, that would be an entire episode by itself.
Yes.
It did originate in China, we think. Anyway, what's interesting about marijuana and the history of its use and growth is that policies around it, attitudes around it, have really kind of ebbed and flowed over the years. It hasn't been one straight trajectory in a negative direction like we tend to view it today. It's kind of been up and down. Starting in the 17th century, if you look at the American colonies, the production of hemp was actually encouraged for use in rope, sails, and clothing. And years later, George Washington and Jefferson actually grew it.
Yeah, and the first draft of the Declaration of Independence was actually written on hemp paper, which I'm sure marijuana enthusiasts probably already know and are fist pumping to right now. And just to clarify, hemp refers to the stalks, stems, and sterilized seeds of cannabis sativa. Marijuana is the leaves, flowers, and the viable seeds of that plant. So it's like different words for different parts of the plant.
Right. Well, so looking at the 19th century and the way they viewed and used cannabis, they used it in more of a medical way. Cannabis became a really popular ingredient in a lot of medical products and was sold in pharmacies. It was so popular for medical use, in fact, that Queen Victoria's personal physician prescribed a hemp solution to help relieve her painful menstrual cramps.
Yeah, we found a lot of fascinating cultural history of marijuana and hashish smoking and weed smoking from Martin A. Lee's book, Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana. And he noted that in 1842, an Irish guy named William O'Shaughnessy published the first modern medical article about cannabis to appear in a British scientific journals. And it was read, though, by both people in the UK and in the fledgling United States. And he noted, though, that the general effects of hemp, which he had traveled to India, and this is where he first saw people smoking hashish and marijuana. And he described the side effects as perpetual giggling, ravenous appetite, a sensation of ascending mental exaltation. And he also emphasized its potent pain-killing effects and called it an anti-convulsive remedy of the greatest value.
Well, so that sounds like a pretty good pain remedy, a pretty good medical answer to a lot of ailments.
Sounds like a wonder drug to me, Caroline.
Interesting. Well, yeah, even sweetheart Louisa May Alcott in 1869 wrote a short story depicting the recreational use of cannabis. Not a medical use, not, you know, making sales out of hemp, but just, you know, hanging out.
Yeah.
Smoking marijuana.
Well, they weren't even smoking it. This story made me laugh because they were using early edibles.
Oh, that's right.
They were bonbons laced with pot that a doctor, like, proffered to this bored socialite. She was like, I need some excitement in my life. And this doctor was like, why don't you eat some weed?
Yeah, I'm picturing some man with a nefarious looking man with a mustache and a cape.
Yes.
Like here, and he opens his cape and he's got all these brownies tucked inside.
Exactly. And coming from Louisa May Alcott.
I know. Mm. Well, so, I mean, continuing the shift in attitudes, it's really interesting to see what happens starting in the 20th century because we get good old fashioned racism changing the way we view and use marijuana.
Yeah. I mean, Martin A. Lee notes in his book that by the end of the 19th century, smoking hashish was really seen as a stylish bohemian thing to do. Upper class people would go to lounges and get stoned. And it really wasn't until you have more Mexican immigrants entering the U.S. and the Mexican Revolution in 1910 that you start seeing all of these, just like all of this anti-marijuana propaganda coming out, talking about how Mexicans are smoking it and it gives them superhuman strength and they just become these killing machines and they're giving it to school children.
Right.
Really a lot of scare tactics we still kind of hear today.
Right. And it's, you know, we see this a lot in various social stigma areas where something terrible is going on in society and we pin our fears on a scapegoat group. And in this case, it was the foreigners, the Spanish speaking foreigners who scared us. Because when you look at the 1930s, you know, we have the Great Depression going on. You have massive unemployment. This increases public resentment of these immigrants. And it escalates concern both about the immigrants themselves and this marijuana cigarettes that they're smoking.
Yeah, they called it the marijuana menace. And just for one brief geographical note, the way that marijuana kind of worked its way like from Mexico into the United States is that essentially what they think happened is slaves who were brought over to Brazil brought cannabis seeds with them, and then from Brazil it sort of snuck its way up all the way to Mexico and then into the United States. Because, you know, when George Washington was growing all this hemp and there was just hemp everywhere, a lot of people weren't smoking it just because they didn't know you could smoke it.
Right.
So, and meanwhile you have people like William O'Shaughnessy going to India and seeing people smoke hashish, like a different form of marijuana, and then bringing that over. So then everything starts to combine and there's this terrifying marijuana menace.
It's just a big, it's Slimer. It's just Slimer.
Which is appropriate for the green color.
Well, so then in the 1930s, you start to see a lot of dominoes falling as far as policy is concerned. In 1930, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics is created and Henry J. Anslinger serves as first commissioner. By 1931, 29 states had already outlawed marijuana. And side note, in 1936, that's when we get the propaganda film Reefer Madness.
And Anslinger, by the way, was really intense in his dislike of marijuana. And he also, in a similarly racist bent to that anti-Mexican immigrant sentiment, also was on the lookout specifically for black musicians of the jazz movement who were also into weed. And he actually kept a special file called Marijuana and Musicians, keeping tabs on people like Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, Jimmy Dorsey, and Duke Ellington.
Interesting. Yeah, so in 1937, two things happen. One, Congress passes the Marijuana Tax Act, which effectively criminalizes marijuana, restricting possession of the drug to people who paid an excise tax for certain authorized medical and industrial uses. So still we're seeing that, okay, some medical uses are okay, but we're seeing a move towards kind of outlawing marijuana, basically. But also in 1937, Anslinger pens the unintentionally hilarious essay, Marijuana, the Assassin of Youth.
I tell you what, I mean, the thing is, the way Anslinger describes the effects of marijuana, it sounds, as I was reading it last night, I read a part out loud to my boyfriend. He was like, that drug sounds amazing, whatever it is. Because it's like, he's like, marijuana will turn you into someone who will dance all night and forget their cares.
Obviously, that's someone who's never smoked marijuana.
Yeah. Well, but then he follows it up with, and then you kill yourself or you turn into some kind of murderous monster.
Right. Yeah. Like from the very beginning of that essay, he's painting young girls as like this vulnerable population because he describes this crime scene and it's the sprawled out body of a young girl crushed on the sidewalk after a plunge from an apartment house. Everybody called it a suicide, but actually it was murder. The killer was a narcotic known to America as marijuana and to history as hashish.
And it is around this time we start to see more in like the 40s, 50s, and 60s, these dubious studies linking marijuana to all sorts of criminal activity, and not criminal activity in the sense of like organized crime rings or drug rings, I should say, but criminal activity in terms of kids smoking a joint and then just breaking windows and, you know, jumping off buildings. And sort of the same thing, too. It reminds me of that classic anti-drug PSA starring a very young Helen Hunt, where she smokes PCP and then jumps out the window. A lot of the symptoms they were associating with marijuana were a lot more like things that you might more plausibly see in as side effects of drugs like PCP
right.
and meth.
Right. Yeah. They. Yeah. Scare tactics. Yeah. So through the 1950s and 60s, marijuana gets more popular with the counterculture, of course. Think about, you know, Summer of Love, hippies, free love, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time that it's getting more popular with hippies, it's also making inroads into the living rooms of the white upper classes. So it's definitely kind of an equal opportunity substance. But in the 1970s, after all of that stuff with Anslinger and the Marijuana Tax Act, we see efforts to lessen sentences and decriminalize marijuana alongside more conservative social movements to get rid of it and say that it's a terrible influence on all of our young people.
Yeah, in 1969, famed anthropologist Margaret Mead actually testified before Congress that, yes, she had tried it and that it should be legalized. And I did not know before researching for this podcast, Caroline, there's actually a congressionally appointed committee that looked into all of the research on marijuana and all of the laws, and they recommended to President Nixon that he should decriminalize it. And he was like, nope, I am not a crook, and I'm not going to decriminalize weed. And that was my Nixon impression.
That's right. She's waving peace signs in the air right now.
That's right.
But so it's interesting that the things that are happening parallel to one another in the 1970s, because in 73, the DEA is founded, and a year later in 74, you have High Times founded, which is a publication for marijuana aficionados.
Yeah, I think the original concept for it was Playboy meets marijuana.
Yeah, so you have like centerfolds of plants instead of ladies.
Or you have naked or nearly naked ladies with marijuana nuggets covering unmentionable areas.
Their bathing suit areas?
Their bathing suit areas.
Right.
Caroline.
And actually, we won't get into it yet. We'll talk about this later. But that whole use of naked women or scantily clad women in High Times plays into what marijuana culture would become.
Yeah.
But so in 76, you have a lot of conservative parents groups lobbying for stricter regulations of marijuana and the prevention of drug use by teenagers. And a lot of those groups ended up becoming very influential, helping to shape a lot of policies that we saw develop in the 1980s.
Yeah, there was actually a milestone event in this anti-marijuana backlash that happened here in our podcast backyards, Caroline, in Atlanta. Apparently, in August of 1976, there was this birthday party for, I think it was this girl's 12th birthday or something. And the way the story was recounted sounds very strange, so I'm curious to know more details about it. But apparently, this girl's parents, Ron and Marcia Manette, went out into their backyard after the partygoers had gone home. They had flashlights and were searching through the grass and found all of these, like, joint roaches and other paraphernalia and a lot of, like, malt liquor. And because they were so enraged by the use of drugs, even more so, I guess, than the alcohol, they formed the Nosy Parents Association. And that effectively kicked off this massive conservative parent-led backlash against marijuana, because they said, my daughter was turning 12 years old and people were smoking joints. Here I am again, President Nixon, apparently. But and that set off this chain of events to 1986 with Ronald Reagan signing the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, which ratcheted everything back way, way up and then some.
Yeah.
For weed laws.
Yeah, weed became on par with heroin in terms of, like, being accused of crimes and being sentenced for crimes.
Well, and considering how dangerous it was, saying that marijuana is as dangerous as heroin, I mean, that's quite a leap.
That it just sounds like more people who've never smoked marijuana.
Yeah.
that in 1989, we have George Bush the first, his war on drugs starting. And in 1996, we see that California voters, and it's interesting because as goes California, so goes the rest of the country. California voters passed Prop 215, allowing for the sale and medical use of marijuana for patients with AIDS, cancer, and other serious and painful diseases. So you can see that throughout history, nobody has ever really denied those very, very, very early opinions on marijuana, that they were helpful, or cannabis, that it was helpful for painful conditions or just to help you sleep.
Yeah. And today, though, even though we have, for instance, most recently in 2012, Washington and Colorado voting to legalize marijuana, and still in California, if you have a medical marijuana license, you can buy it from dispensaries. But it is still classified as a Schedule I drug, which means that federally speaking, no matter what state you live in, federal law puts it on par with drugs like heroin, LSD, and ecstasy.
Yeah, they claim also if it's a Schedule I drug, that means that it has no current accepted medical use in the U.S. and a high potential for abuse, which, you know, goes against a lot of other things that a lot of other people have said, which basically means that pot is somehow worse than cocaine and meth.
Yeah, because what they're saying is that there have been medicinal uses somehow for derivatives of those other drugs.
Right.
Even though you do have, for instance, a synthetic THC product called Marinol, which has been developed specifically to help control nausea and vomiting, side effects from things like chemotherapy, and also to stimulate appetite in AIDS patients. And in 1999, Marinol was labeled as a Schedule III drug, meaning it has a moderate to low potential for physical and psychological dependence. One thing, I wish I had written down the name of the specific drug, but it's not a synthetic THC product. It is actually a THC compound derived straight from marijuana that Georgia lawmakers are actually trying to make legal in this state, which is notable simply because Georgia is so conservative. I mean,
right.
Hello, we're the birthplace of the nosy parent society.
Right.
But these lawmakers are saying that it's important for, I think it's helping for side effects for kids with
Seizures.
Mm-hmm. And of course, other lawmakers argue, well, this is a slippery slope towards putting a joint in the hand of every school child in Georgia, which you're nope.
But even I mean, not to get too much off on a local politics tangent, but even conservative Governor Nathan Deal, because the medical marijuana thing failed, even Deal has said that he would try to work something out, kind of working around the legislature. So even Nathan Deal sees the benefit of helping children who have these life-threatening seizures. But anyway, speaking of its medical use, medical marijuana is legal in 20 states and D.C. So there's something to it.
And before we get into gender, because I have a feeling some of our listeners have been like, what? But what about women and weed? You said this was going to be women and weed. Don't worry. There is so much to talk about in terms of gender, women, and marijuana. But before we get into our mid-roll break, I just want to first run down quickly today, who is smoking weed in the United States? Well, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 18.1 million Americans over 12 years old in 2010 said that, yes, they had smoked pot in the past 30 days. Over 50% now, according to the ACLU, of Americans also support the legalization of marijuana. And in 2013, if you look at older Americans, 38% of adults say that they've tried it. And the average age of smoking marijuana for the first time as of 2012 was 17.9 years. But, and now we will lead into gender, Caroline, men are twice as likely to report smoking it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into the gender of marijuana consumption when we come right back from a quick break. And now back to the show.
Okay, so right before the break, Kristen was giving you a breakdown of who is smoking marijuana in the U.S., and she did mention that guys are a lot more likely than women to say that they have smoked marijuana. But let's talk a little bit about age first, because that gender gap, and there is one, definitely appears right out of the gate. So we found a lot of studies, basically looking at the gender breakdown among adolescents, because as a study in sex roles from 1999 points out, marijuana is conspicuous as a token of leisure and sociability in adolescent culture, and adolescents tend to get it from their peers. And one of the other studies we looked at from the Journal of Addictive Medication in 2011 pointed out that while male adolescents are more likely to use marijuana, girls transition from first use to regular use faster than guys do. Although, they cite previous research, male adolescents are more likely to become dependent in the first few years after initiation. So there you have the development of more dudes are doing it.
And if you look at overall numbers, though, of high schoolers who have smoked pot, 42% of high school seniors said that they had used marijuana at some point in their lives, according to 2008 data. And if you look at the gender breakdown of that, I mean, the percentage of boys versus girls who have tried pot in, say, middle school or high school isn't huge. They found 29% of the guys that they polled said that they had smoked pot in the past year, compared to 24% of girls. So there's clearly a little, you know, a few more guys who are doing it. But what's even more significant is that a lot of times, Caroline, you mentioned that a lot of times these kids will get weed from other kids, and it's usually boy kids mm-hmm. that they're getting the weed from. And there was even in that sex role study, what they did was essentially set up these focus groups with kids, asking them about times they had smoked pot, what their perceptions were of girls and guys who smoked pot, and basically said that if a girl is smoking pot, she's usually kind of a, you know, one girl among many guys, mm-hmm. and that it's considered more of a guy thing and not very ladylike, should we say, to smoke pot.
Well, that's something that somebody actually said. Like, you know, somebody was saying, my mother told me not to do it because it wasn't the ladylike thing to do, that this is something that just stoner guys do. Women are supposed to hold it together. But, that sex roles study from 99 was talking about how these traditional roles, these boxes that we're in, limit girls in their access to that particular form of leisure. It's supposed to be just a guy thing. And if girls are doing it, oh, well, they must be kind of, they're floozies, pot floozies.
Oh, pot floozies. Going back to old reefer madness.
Right.
But I found it interesting, too, that when these researchers in that Journal of Addictive Medication study were looking at the demographics of who was smoking pot in high school, they found that white girls, essentially, were among all of the girls, had the highest likelihood of doing it, which is in contrast to, if you look at arrest numbers for marijuana offenses, African Americans, 4 times mm-hmm. as likely to be arrested, even though, especially if you move into the adult populations, they're not smoking it any more than white people are
right.
smoking it.
Yeah, and among adolescent males, African American or Hispanic and Latino ethnicity was associated with greater odds of past 30-day use in that study. So there is a divide there as well.
And one thing about this episode we should point out, we're not going to get deeply into the health aspects of marijuana. We're not going to debate whether or not it's healthy or unhealthy to smoke marijuana compared to drinking alcohol. But we should note, especially for younger populations, a lot of these studies are focused on the concern of kids smoking pot, because mm-hmm. you would think with developing brains and all that, probably not a great idea for kids to be smoking pot. And most of these studies tend to find negative behavioral correlates to adolescent pot use, such as having lower grades or having behavioral problems, girls in particular dealing with anxiety and depression, which I have a feeling you would see reflected also in the adult female population who is smoking pot. But then you also get into issues of correlation versus causation that a lot of these studies don't really address very much.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look just at all of these study abstracts, it does make it look a little marijuana menace-y, saying that only bad kids are smoking weed and smoking weed makes kids bad, whereas it's probably a variable in a whole cocktail
right.
of things happening.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah, totally. Well, if we look at those adolescent girls as they grow up, they are playing a major part in this conversation that a lot of people are having today around kind of marijuana, the use of it, the whole industry as a whole. Especially since we tend to have this stereotype of pot smokers as being, you know, the Big Lebowski.
Yeah. I mean, there's the whole trope of, and he's usually white, which is also important. We'll get into that as well. But the whole trope of the slacker stoner dude. I mean, just think about all of the movies. You have Half Baked, Friday, The Big Lebowski, Pineapple Express, This Is the End. I may or may not, when I was in high school, have seen the movie How High, starring Method Man, in the theater. I mean, what else are you going to do on a Friday night? But there, I mean, it's endless. And when there are girls, or even in Knocked Up, where Seth Rogen and his friends mm-hmm. are always hanging out, taking bong rips, and meanwhile, the women are busy getting their lives together.
Yeah, the women are all nags. They're busy getting their lives together. They're not partaking in the pot smoking. And McLean's magazine in March 2014 looked at that division of how, like, if there is a stoner, if there's a male stoner character, there are no apologies for his behavior. You sort of accept him as he is, and it's okay because he's a lovable guy. He's hanging out in his basketball shorts, just smoking pot and eating Doritos, and that's okay. That's what we expect. And it's also that these guys, like Kristen said, are normally white. So it's safe because it's not playing off of what we like dangerous stereotypes.
Yeah, because if you look in pop culture at weed among white guys, it's this sort of lovable, soft slacker dude. Whereas if you look at pop culture stereotypes of weed and black guys, it's usually tied into crime or portrayals mm-hmm. of gang activity,
right.
Or they're the ones who are dealing to the slacker white guys. And this is something that sociologist Wendy Chapkiss addressed in her essay called The Trouble with Mary Jane's Gender that she wrote in 2013. And she said, quote, "The slacker attitude relies on a mismatch between expectation and condition. This is why it's most available to white hetero men with some measure of class privilege."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so yet again, you still kind of see, in a way, echoes of that early 20th century racism that first planted the seeds in the American public's mind as marijuana being, you know, something bad, something that, you know, these other people would do, not, mm-hmm. not our, you know, our good, upright American citizens. And yet now, with white guys doing it, it is sort of like the trope has been molded to where it's not necessarily acceptable, but kind of lovable and acceptable.
Right.
Who doesn't love the dude?
But women aren't really afforded that. And so in talking about the new show Broad City, McLean's magazine points out that, you know, here are two women who are kind of paving the way in somewhat because they're not making apologies for their behavior. And they even mention screenwriter Jamie Denbo's Best Buds, a stoner comedy that she's developing with Natalie Portman. And she was telling Jezebel back in 2010 that it's kind of her cause to prove that women can smoke weed too and have fun and still be like contributing members of society.
Yeah, I mean, because if you think about, for instance, how prominent a role that alcohol plays in a, you know, the most seminal female show of all time, can we call it Sex and the City, where they tend to go out at least once during every show. They have their, you know, their cosmopolitans. They even have signature drinks that they get. And it's interesting to see how, I mean, weed doesn't play as prominent a role, I would say, in Broad City. But nonetheless, you have Alana and Abby openly smoking weed or looking for weed. And it's kind of treated in the same kind of way as going out and getting cosmos is mm-hmm. among Carrie and the gals, which is sort of a refreshing twist. And another thing, too, that's also refreshing about Broad City's portrayal of this is that a lot of times in those like stoner dude kind of comedies, they might have a token girl who's also a stoner, but she's usually seen as sort of pathetic. The fact that she would be playing video games and eating Cheetos all day is like, oh, poor thing. But for Alana and Abby, it's just like, what? Yeah, no, they're hilarious and they're just going to smoke pot if they want to.
Yeah. And that whole, you know, pathetic girl on the couch is definitely one portrayal of women in weed culture. Another kind of, unfortunately, in my opinion, is the bikini bud tenders. These women who are being hired by pot dispensaries to shill weed like they're Bud Light girls, like, you know, in just little bikinis or nurse outfits. These are also the women who are at conferences and conventions trying to answer questions or just posing for pictures with fans.
Yeah, it reminded me of our craft beer episode that came out recently and how you have these women who are starting to brew their own beer and start up labels and are actually making names for themselves in craft beer, but they still aren't always getting taken seriously because of the legacy of shot girls, of attractive girls being hired to wear, you know, tiny Bud Light bikinis to sell beer. And so because sort of in a similar way as beer has been, you know, more of a predominantly male culture, as is weed, it perpetuates this idea that weed is something that guys do, mm-hmm. and they often do it together, and women are just accessories. And it also, too, ties into the whole high times culture of women just being objects upon which you place marijuana leaves in strategic locations, which, I mean, looking at those centerfolds as we did to prep for this podcast, Caroline, I don't know how men would find that sexy. It just doesn't. I mean, obviously, I can see how attractive women and their bodies are considered sexy. But the pot leaves everywhere is just so silly and cliche to me. Like, it's not very aesthetically pleasing. I don't get that.
So you won't be hanging those up in your cubicle anytime soon?
I mean, if I were a guy, I would just be laughing at myself or laughing at these weed centerfolds rather than being like, ooh. Hubba hubba. Because that's what guys say, right? When they see attractive women.
And then their eyes bug out of their head.
Ooh,
yeah. Well, a lot of scholars would argue that whole tongue-in-cheek, high times centerfold, bikini bud tender culture is actually doing kind of a disservice to a lot of women. Not just the women who are in the magazines themselves, but also kind of women overall who want to be in the culture, want to be in the industry, want to help shape policy reform. Wendy Chapkis, who Kristen cited earlier in her paper from 2013, talks about women's voices being muted while their bodies are hyper-visible in this commercial cannabis culture. And she talks about how by not paying attention to gendered stereotypes and inequalities, we are putting up obstacles to women's full participation in drug policy reform.
Yeah, she even refers to these initiatives to legalize marijuana also as a guy's thing, because if you look at, it's changing a little bit now, but if you look at the predominant leadership among groups that are lobbying for marijuana's legalization in the United States, it usually is mostly men at the top. And it probably ties into these sort of social prejudices against marijuana and maybe a heightened penalty for violating that if you are a woman, because it's already considered sort of an unladylike thing to admit to do. And so she says that it's expected that guys will do it because there is, at least in some, you know, sort of subcultures, sort of a cool cachet to being a dude stoner, brah. I mean, there's an entire show, Workaholics, all about, I mean, I know I was just talking about Broad City and how they smoke pot, but I mean, Workaholics, even before that, is all about guys who would rather smoke pot than go to work.
Yeah, but then you have the pathetic woman stoner character, and I mean, that's just literally swapping out a woman for a man, so that's just another example of women doing male behavior or the male stereotype and being judged for it.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas on the flip side, too, one last thing about those bud tenders, I just also thought it was funny that these women are being hired to wear sexy pot clothes, if you want to call them clothes, because normally they're kind of too small to constitute clothing. But it's like, if you get a group of stoners in a room, you don't need anything else to help sell weed, except weed, you know?
Right, yeah.
And even if we move away from, say, weed conventions, because yes, weed conventions exist, and on-screen portrayals of stoners, even women who are, you know, in the real world, have real jobs, have their lives together, and enjoy smoking pot, are very hesitant about coming out of what is referred to as the weed closet. Mm-hmm. Anne Friedman, who we cite so many times in the podcast, she wrote a piece for New York Magazine in 2013 and was talking to women about their pot habits, and none of them wanted to be named because of either because A, in a lot of places, it's still illegal, and so they didn't want to put themselves out there, you know, for any kind of workplace risk, but also just not wanting to have any kind of negative stereotypes saddled to them. Because as soon as you say, oh, well, yeah, I smoke pot, then you might have a laundry list of negative judgments of like, oh, well, wait, you must be some kind of horrible slacker who can't control herself with anything.
Yeah, like I won't be able to trust you to get your job done or whatever.
You must dance all night and then jump through windows.
Yeah, because one woman that Friedman talked to said, you know, I've always been kind of proud of the fact that I'm not the stereotypical pot smoker. You wouldn't look at me and know that I smoke pot. And she says, I have my bleep together.
Yeah. Her bleep.
Her bleep.
Her bleep is all together.
She's got her beep buttoned down.
Well, and that was the same case as with this 2009 Marie Claire article about the quote-unquote stiletto stoners. Mm-hmm. Basically, women who make a good amount of money who smoke pot instead of drink wine to wind down. And one of them went on the record with her name, but the other ones were also all anonymous because they just didn't want to be seen as pot smokers.
Yeah, and the whole thing was like women, working women going home at the end of a long day and unwinding with a blunt instead of a glass of wine. And, you know, talking about how these are all like type A, career track rat race women in power suits who go home and light up, whether alone or with girlfriends, a la Sex and the City. And it does make me wonder, like, did you just realize that women smoke pot?
I think it is sort of this emerging realization, especially because women smoking pot are still being portrayed as trend pieces.
Mm-hmm.
It's still this, you know, we're uncovering these pockets of women doing it. But one thing, too, that came to mind with the stiletto stoners is that the after five cocktail happy hour culture is so accepted as a part of, you know, corporate America, where you're gonna work really hard and then you're gonna go reward yourself with 18 scotches. And that's not a radical idea, even though it's horrifically, you know, potentially damaging to your health.
Yeah.
And expensive. And, you know, yet an occasional weed smoke every now and then is seen as something, you know, that you don't even want to talk about.
Right. Well, because there's this attitude. You think of women involved in marijuana at all as the mothers who are fighting against legalization.
Yeah.
And when you think of men involved, it's either as the stoners or as the people who were, you know, angling for marijuana to become legalized. And that's just not the case necessarily. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not. But there is a bigger internet presence, for instance, for women. Websites like ladybud.com, womensmarijuanamovement.org. There's even the quote-unquote marijuana mommies going on CNN to say that smoking makes them better moms. So there's a lot more diversity going on and a lot more openness, I think, in industry involvement. Industry or just culture involvement.
Yeah, and with the whole mom angle, too, for people involved in legalization activism, they are trying to target moms more. For instance, when Washington voted in 2012 to legalize marijuana, they cited women voting, and specifically this one ad that was released right before the election that depicted this soccer mom type talking about all of the different ways that legalizing marijuana and the tax benefits from that and how it would enrich school systems. There would be ID checks to make sure that kids wouldn't be able to just walk up to a dispensary and buy it. And also how by freeing up all of the law enforcement resources that are focused on marijuana arrests, diverting that into, you know, other areas that will help make kids safer. it was a brilliant tactic.
Yeah.
And 50% of women voters in Washington voted for legalization.
Right. Because, and yeah, and they talked to basically the people who were behind this marketing push. And yeah, once you get moms on board with the fact that this regulation has a lot more to do with your family's safety than it does with, you know, Stoner Joe down the street getting high and potentially, like, I don't know, driving a car through your backyard. You know, like, once you change the focus, Stoner Joe.
Caroline, Stoner Joe's not going to get up.
I know. Exactly. Well, that's exactly what you have to educate people about what marijuana is going to do to you.
Stoner Joe is playing World of Warcraft and eating pizza rolls and having a great time doing it.
That sounds like what Dude Roommate does without any sort of substance.
I now just want pizza rolls. But let's look at another area too where women are being recognized and also making inroads on their own. Kind of similar again to our craft brewing podcast. And that's within the actual industry. We've talked about women consuming marijuana, buying marijuana, voting for the legalization of marijuana. But what about the women, like the ones who this podcast is dedicated to, tending to the actual plants?
Yeah, more and more women are actually joining the industry now that it's maturing. They might not necessarily be doing the same exact things that the men are doing. There was an article in Elle and a study by Karen August from Humboldt State University in 2013 talking about how there is just this army of women behind male weed farmers or just the men who are dominating the industry in general.
Yeah, Karen August, the Humboldt State University researcher, did note that women growers, who are the people that she wanted to talk to, but women growers are still on a large scale, pretty few or far between. And so there aren't even really any studies at all on women growing. But if you look at the marijuana farming process, you do see a gender gap in who's doing more of the manual labor in the farms and who does the trimming. Women are often relegated to trimming the buds because it's not as I don't want to say physically demanding because I'm sure it's very tedious work, but it doesn't require as much physical strength. You're not having to move these massive plants around.
Right. And she also talks about the female-led kind of legitimate employment that surrounds the industry, like these cottage industries that are springing up around marijuana farms, selling paraphernalia, selling edibles, things like that, even clothing lines, posters, marijuana art. But it's often women creating these things.
Yeah, I did a quick search on Etsy for marijuana-related goods, and not to say that every, you know, Etsy account is run by a woman, but let's just say there was a lot of feminine-looking marijuana paraphernalia being made by artisans all over the world. And Marie Claire also cited women like Betty Aldworth, who's the deputy director of the National Cannabis Industry Association in Colorado. There's also Dale Sky Jones, who's executive chancellor of Oaksterdam University, which is a school set up specifically to teach people how to grow, tend, and start marijuana businesses. And Jennifer Murray, who is the CEO of Can Labs, which is focused on looking at different applications for marijuana, whether it's, more for therapeutic and medicinal effects. So there are, you know, these different women doing all sorts of things within the industry. And I think that slowly but surely we might be chipping away at the idea of, you know, being exclusively something that the stoner guys, stoner bros do, brah.
Yeah. Well, and in contrast to our stereotype of the, you know, angry conservative mother fighting against marijuana legalization, you have this new image of a young mother fighting for legalization because she is a mother, because she does have children who would benefit from the legalization of medical marijuana. The Atlantic looked at this back in 2013, saying that women have long been involved in this fight. If you look back to the 1980s, you have Mary Jane, very appropriately named, Mary Jane Ruthven, better known as Brownie Mary. She's a well-known medical marijuana activist who would bake pot-laced brownie for AIDS patients in San Francisco. And in 1996, around the time that voters in California approved that proposition, you have TV ads targeting women in support of legalizing medical marijuana use. And the ad featured a 67-year-old nurse whose husband used it when he was dying of cancer. So they're trying to drive home the fact that there is this medical marijuana that could help families, but also more women are just getting behind it because they do use it for recreation.
And what do you think about mothers who advocate on behalf of, you know, legalized marijuana, whether it's medicinal or not? It's incredibly brave because they're not just risking violating some, you know, run-of-the-mill gender norms, but they're also risking putting themselves in situations where people accuse them of being bad mothers and possibly getting their kids taken away from them, which is a nightmare scenario that activist Renee Petro found herself in recently when she was investigated by the Florida Child Protection Services based on a tip, an anonymous tip, that she was giving her son, who has a rare form of epilepsy, cannabis extract, which she was not doing at all.
Yeah.
But they came into her home and demanded to interview her son in a different room about whether or not his mom was giving him weed.
Well, I mean, yeah. And speaking of Georgia, you know, now that Colorado has legalized medical marijuana, I mean, I was listening to a story on NPR where all these families, they talked to some families in Georgia who were like, I'm moving there because my kid has this life-threatening form of epilepsy. Wouldn't you move to help your child? And so that's where that's where all the politics go head to head with actually protecting our children and what do they need. But yeah, along those same lines, Debbie Goldsberry, who's the founder of the Berkeley Patients Group, one of the largest dispensaries in California, was interviewed in 2011 by High Times and basically confirms what Kristen was talking about. You know, we've had our children to protect this whole time, she says. It was scary because kids were being taken from their parents who were arrested for simple possession. And she talks about how she was an activist long before she was ever a mother because she was scared to. She didn't know if she would be accused inaccurately of being a bad mother.
Yeah, I mean, and the whole kids angle to the war on drugs has always baffled me a bit because in those studies, it's confirmed over and over again that when kids want to get their hands on marijuana, they do, and they often do it from other kids. Like, it's just, it being illegal is not making it any safer for these children.
Sure, because then you're going to get it from some dummy who's, and it's going to be laced with something and, you know, they're not going to do it at home. I don't,
And then you might be Helen Hunt jumping out of a window.
That's exactly right. But there are activist women organizing and there are these groups, include Normal Women's Alliance, Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, and Moms for Marijuana that support not only marijuana use by women, but they're also like actively trying to change drug laws.
And as the case of Washington and Colorado's legalization efforts have shown, women are, you know, really a crucial demographic to legalizing marijuana. And it'll be interesting to see in the coming years how those examples in those states might shape legalization efforts in other states. And I will be curious to see how quickly legalization spreads across the United States. Because, I mean, again, we have not gotten into the health impacts of smoking marijuana. I mean, regularly smoking anything obviously is not good for you. All of the studies that suggest that it's harmful to short-term and even long-term memory. Don't get us wrong, we understand that there are negative effects of marijuana, as there are negative effects to other drugs and also alcohol, cigarettes, things that are plenty legal in the United States as well.
But a lot of these activists would argue, look, I'm not trying to get my kid to smoke a joint. I'm just trying to give him cannabis extract so he doesn't have seizures and die.
Or I will say that I know at least one marijuana mommy who, after she had her kid, not while she was pregnant, people, don't worry, but after she became a mother, she had smoked occasionally beforehand, but she became a fairly regular pot smoker because she was just like, it really helps me deal with things. It really does.
Well, yeah, and I have a friend who has a really severe case of Crohn's disease, and she was on all this medication for a long time. She was just sick as a dog all the time, and she smokes marijuana just so that she can eat.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, I think if anything, no matter what side of, you know, the legalization debate that you stand on, it's worthwhile to consider where, especially if you're in the U.S., because this is a very U.S.-centric conversation we've been having, but where that American dislike or distaste for the marijuana menace really came from, because it is rooted in a very dark place of racism.
Yeah, it went from treating a queen's cramps to being called a menace because it was associated with the other, the foreign other.
Yeah. So now we want to hear from you out there. What do you think about marijuana culture and all of its gendered aspects? Are you a woman who might be out in Humboldt County tending to harvest? I don't know when harvest is. So you might be like, no, there's like nothing to harvest right now. Are you a lady who enjoys a joint after a long day at work? We want to hear from you. We won't rat you out to your bosses. Let us know all of your marijuana thoughts. MomStuffAtDiscovery.com is where you can email us. And you can also tweet us at MomStuffPodcast or send us a message on Facebook. And we've got a couple of messages to share with you. Speaking of our craft beer episode yet again, about craft beer. So I've got one here from Eli, and he said, "Hi, ladies. After listening to your Craft Beer Brewsters podcast, I have a couple of things I wanted to write you about. When my girlfriend and I go out to the bar after we've ordered our beers, we'll either look at the bottles or look up the ABV on her smartphone. At least two-thirds of the time, she will have gotten a beer that is significantly stronger than whenever I'm drinking. I don't know if she's going for economy or just trying to spite some people she knows who say, 'Girls don't drink beer.' Also, she announced last month that she thought we needed a hobby we could do together. I immediately thought she meant fixing up some of the furniture we'd bought or something like that. But no, we're going to start homebrewing beer." Which sounds like a fun hobby. So thanks, Eli.
And I have a letter here from Phoenix who says, "I recently got a job as a part-time brand ambassador, read promotional model, for a small local craft brewer. The company is so small that I actually get paid in beer. It is quite excellent and expensive, so I'm not complaining. Your podcast inspired me to share my experience. Both the owners and brewers for the company are men. There are two other brand ambassadors, also men. I am the only woman on staff. This is absolutely not a problem in the workplace. Everyone respects my opinions and knowledge of the beer. When I go out for tasting, I find myself in a very different situation. Most people like my beers, but most of the comments I get are about me. 'This is really good, but you haven't even tried it. Pretty girls like you don't like beer this strong.' Or occasionally, 'What agency do you work for?' Questions none of my male colleagues receive. It is frustrating, but when I give my honest opinions on the brew, these men typically have a change of heart. I get approached less by women, and most who come up are afraid all my beers will be bitter. I have never sold a whole case to a woman, but usually I can find a sample they like. As a response to your numerous comments about the Bud Light girls or chicks with big boobs selling beer, I was taken aback. I have big boobs, naturally blonde hair, and an athletic body from being a professional equine dentist. Though this is definitely a reason some people question my sincere passion for beer, I want you and other listeners to know that girls with big boobs can really like beer too. Please help me stop stereotyping the busty women in beer. Cheers, Phoenix." So thank you, Phoenix. I think, you know, women with boobs or no boobs or some boobs are allowed to drink and love whatever they want.
Yeah, I hope we didn't seem like we were anti-big boobs. We're pro, I should say, all boobs.
We're pro boobs.
Yeah, pro boobs.
In whatever shape, size, color, orientation. And by orientation, I mean which way they're pointing.
Nipple number.
Yeah, whatever.
We support them all.
All of it.
We support the boobs. So, if you have thoughts that you want to share with us, momstuffatdiscovery.com is our email address to find links to all of our social, as well as all of the sources that we cited in today's podcast. Along with all of our blogs and videos, there's one place to go. It's stuffmomnevertoldyou.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.